Emily?
I'd like to thank the commission for letting me come in a little late. I drove a long way, and I was tremendously hungry. I couldn't, could not wait. My name is Emily Posner. I am here on behalf of Maine Earth First and the Defending Water for Life campaign. I come from Montville, Maine, which is bordering the town of Freedom, Maine, where there are three large wind turbines that have now displaced a few of my neighbors who have moved away from Freedom as a result of the devastation that that project has brought to our community. And I'm here to speak on a couple different points. The first, I'd like to sort of read an adaption of something that I wrote when my town was considering and has since passed a very strict regulatory wind development ordinance in our town. And as well, I'd like to read a letter to the editor that was published in Alaska from a man who has traveled to Alberta, Canada, which is the home of TransCanada, to talk a little bit about their corporate citizenship or lack thereof in that community with the indigenous population of the region. So I'll begin with a short piece that I wrote for my community in Montville. Off and on for the past many years, I often find myself overcome by a sadness about the ecological condition and the planet and the barriers we face to heal our sick Mother Earth. I recently downloaded and read much of the University of Maine's report, Maine's Climate Future, and to be honest, the findings do not necessarily make me super excited to be a 20-something-year-old in these times. When I let my brain really assess the realities of the changing climate, I get really upset and at times scared about what our future may bring. I do not want to see my friends in New Orleans collectively forced to relocate because their city is sinking into the ocean, nor do I want to get Lyme's disease or see my Maine communities flood during the spring or lose the short winter of maple syrup. These are emotions that I think many of us have felt before proposed wind projects have come to our communities, and it's hard to figure out exactly what to do. But today, the residents of this state must make some very tough decisions. We have to make serious decisions that will impact the natural and human communities of our town and our areas for generations to come. And instead, these decisions must reflect a growing paradigm that recognizes the global implications of acting locally. We have all heard the phrase, think global and act local, and most connect the jingle with economic activity, as the phrase is often associated with using our purchase power to confront international free trade policies by supporting local enterprise, by buying produce at the farmer's market or shopping at the local hardware store. But today I hope that LIRC can use this phrase as a backbone to its land use decisions. For the better part of my life, I have worked to confront an economic agenda that sacrifices the health and well-being of our communities throughout the world in order to consolidate wealth and power amongst a select few. I also have worked to develop strategies and local initiatives that find solutions to an economic system that has undermined local businesses, farms, and the environment.
Can you slow down just a little bit?
I certainly can. I'm a firm believer in the ideology of thinking globally and acting locally, and believe that our culture must develop diverse, locally specific solutions to the great many global problems that impact our lives. Because we are dealing with the production of energy, I more strongly believe that our community needs to actively explore land use decisions that address how this form of development can benefit our entire community and state. I believe that energy, like food, water, and shelter, is a basic human right. And subsequently, the production, distribution, and economic benefits should be governed from this principle, and all land use decisions should be made from this principle as well. The possibilities of massive profit can corrupt what may be good intentions from the development of this essential service. It is for this reason that many utilities used to be publicly owned, and why thousands of rural electrical cooperatives were created during the Great Depression, when there was a giant federal push to bring electricity to every American, very similar to the federal push right now to convert our energy. I'm going to skip ahead. While I'm not a professional economist, I think today we heard a lot of different perspectives on what kind of economic benefits these projects may or may not bring. However, for the better part of the last 10 years, I have studied the impacts of neoliberal free trade economic policies, the parabolic growth and development of the global economy over the last four centuries is paralleled by the emergence and subsequent conglomeration of major domestic and transnational corporations. From the days of the East Indian Trade Company and Pacific Railroad to today's Shell, Monsanto, Coca-Cola, Nestle, and TransCanada, Large corporate forces have played an extraordinary role in our economy and a society. We face some serious challenges today, as global economic forces have left much of our state's economy in utter shambles. The International Free Trade Economic Agenda has decimated Maine's manufacturing industries, and today it is the same economic agenda and often the same corporate players that are coming after what we have left in this great state: our land, our fiber, our wind, and our water. Subsequently, small and relatively poor communities throughout our state are regularly having to make decisions in the face of this kind of power of major profit-driven institutions. The development of the wind industry cannot be exempt from this discussion. Small towns throughout this region have been approached by wind development companies, and from my understanding, it is this model of development is no different from models that leave the everyday person fighting over the drops that might trickle down. This political economic model is flawed, and it is these major insufficiencies and concentration of power that has allowed serious and complex global forces to destabilize and threaten international water supplies, international climatic systems, and the global economy. Today, our community is at an enormous moment of opportunity to choose a new economic path, and our communities throughout the state and nation have been forced to talk about what restructuring our economy would look like at this time of great change. A small group of shareholders stand to profit greatly from this type of proposal. Equitable development must be the foundation for a truly sustainable future, and your decisions today must reflect the available economic, environmental, and social evidence that clearly demonstrates the need for new models. I begin attempting, I'm going to probably close off right there. And the other thing that I would like to read was first published in the Juneau Empire, which is a newspaper in Alaska, and I find this really interesting because this guy is nowhere near Alberta, and he decided to write this letter to the editor about the role that TransCanada has played in the communities in Alberta. In July 2001, I drove my rental car. His name is William Cox. I drove my rental car in the village of Little Buffalo Capital to the Lubicon Cree Indian Nation in the vast boreal forest of northern Alberta. They fed me lunch and never gave me a bill. Elder Renee Jobin gave me a tour of their lands, and I met Chief Bernard Ominayak, and I learned of a nation under siege. Overlooked when a treaty was signed with other Aboriginals in 1899, the Lubicon were promised a reserve 40 years later that never materialized. They never ceded their ancestral lands or signed a treaty with Alberta or Canada. Industry laid siege, and during the last 25 years, billions of dollars of oil and gas and timber have been taken from their traditional lands, leaving the Lubicon decimated with a compromised water supply, third world diseases, birth defects, and an epidemic of suicides and other social ills. With unwavering government support, it is proving easier and vastly more profitable for industry to simply continue the siege.
You need to slow down just a little bit.
And wear them down over time than to sincerely negotiate. Yes, a slow genocide by attrition is taking place in our so-called civilized neighbor of Canada. A couple years ago, TransCanada Corporation joined the fray with a proposed 42-inch natural gas pipeline across unceded and disputed Lubicon land. It would supply natural gas to cook the vast tar sands for oil, the most environmentally destructive project on Earth. The Lubicon were denied standing before the Alberta Utilities Commission, which ultimately issued the license. A political business duopoly rules Alberta, supported by most part by a complement judiciary. Advisors to the Lubicon have their telephone calls monitored, mail opened, and emails diverted. With the deck stacked against them, the Lubicon appealed to the United Nations. Three separate UN bodies, the UN Human Rights Committee, the UN Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the UN Special Rapporteur on Housing, have told TransCanada to cease and desist and respect international covenants. During the AGIA hearings in summer of 2008, I was able to arrange a conference call with TransCanada Vice President Tony Palmer. Patty Bielaski sat in with Palmer in Juneau. I was up in Nome. On the line from Calgary headquarters were Art Cunningham, Eric Mohan, and Mel Johnson. I listened patiently to a rather long-winded overview from the Calgary staff about the people-friendly and culturally sensitive policies of TransCanada. Then I asked my first questions. If things are as you say, why have three UN bodies intervened and condemned TransCanada's treatment of the Lubicon, as well as Amnesty International, multiple European human and indigenous rights groups, and an umbrella group of Canadian churches, and shareholder protests? They had no answer and retreated behind the laws of Alberta and Canada. Unocal responded the same, retreating behind the laws of Burma, while slave laborers were worked to death on their Burmese gas pipeline. Shell Oil responded the same, while the Ogoni people of Nigeria suffered environmental and social catastrophe, and their leader, Kanse Arwiwo, was hung by a Nigerian dictator. I've been to Burma and also met Sarawiwo's son. Verbal cues told me Tony Palmer was getting restless and wanted to get back to the hearings. I asked my fan a question.
You've got to slow down too, because she's having a hard time to follow you.
All right. I will email it to you. I will certainly email it to you. Verbal cues told me Tony Palmer was getting restless and wanted to get back to the hearings. I asked my final question, will you build the North Central Corridor pipeline across unceded and contested Lubicon lands over the objection of the Lubicon in three United Nations bodies? Their answer was an unequivocal yes, but they added an ominous qualifier. We will not build a pipeline in an unsafe environment. I was stunned into silence, and it was not mosquitoes or bears they were worried about. It was clearly physical violence. In summary, TransCanada's reputation in Alberta is atrocious. Riding roughshod over human and Indigenous rights, Alaska demeans itself and dishonors its native people by partnering with TransCanada. All ties with TransCanada should be severed. I really hope that we have serious thoughts about doing any kind of business with this corporation. Thank you.
All right. Mr. or Ms. McKay, Friends of Saddleback. I apologize, I cannot read the first name. Sorry, sir. Dave.
That's a good guess. But Dana. My real name is Dan McKay, and I live in Dixfield, Maine.
It does sort of look like Dan.
Does it?
Yeah.
I'm a graduate civil engineer from the University of Maine. I would say my major interest is in soils. Well, I've spent practically all my life. As a matter of fact, today we put a well in a septic tank. I have worked in the area of Sis Mountain. In, I believe, the year 2004, when Route 27 was reconstructed, that was from the Canadian border right down along the chain of ponds. I'm sure you're familiar with it. You probably are up there today. And I was involved with a lot of earth moving on that project. They tried to take a lot of the twists and turns out of the road and the dips and humps. And we did manage to move a lot of dirt. I saw a lot of dirt. Representative of, I believe, would be Sis Mountain itself, because we actually worked at the foot of these mountains. One day the state engineer came to us and told us about a maintenance problem he was having. Every year they were picking up rocks that would tumble down off from the mountain onto the road, which meant they had to run out, pick them up before they got run over by the logging trucks from Canada. He said, is there any way you can widen this road out in this particular area into the toe of that mountain so that when the rocks fall, they'll fall in the ditch and not onto the hot top? And he thought it over and he said, perhaps we could carve into the toe of the mountain and put a boulder wall up 12-16 feet high, a vertical wall, giving us room to put a ditch in. Sounded reasonable. We built them before. So we brought the excavator over, some dump trucks to haul our dirt off with, and he started digging into the toe of the mountain. Well, he'd take a bucket out, and he'd swing around all the way around to fill his truck. And as he's swinging around, more dirt would fall right down that where he'd just dug before. And he'd turn around, and he'd see either a pile of dirt that wasn't there before. But he was intent on getting that dug out, so he kept bailing. And the more he bailed, the more the dirt just seemed to want to fall right down in front of him. Well, eventually, we had to stop. Because upslope for about 60 feet, the whole earth gave way and left a big crater there. brought down boulders, they brought down trees, and it brought a halt to this operation because there was no way we could repair that. Our backhoe wouldn't reach 60 feet up. Well, we went and got the state engineer. And while he was on his way there, I kind of glanced over to the right because they wanted to build this road for about a couple hundred feet, this wall for a couple hundred feet. And I happened to glance to the right up in the woods. And I do believe I saw the biggest boulder I have ever seen in my life. It was the size of this building. The trees in front of this boulder didn't grow vertical. They grew horizontal. This boulder had been creeping. And I thank God to this day that excavator operator wasn't digging in the toe of that mountain directly below that boulder because he would no longer be alive. What I guess the point I'm trying to say is this soil is a loose soil. It's a sandy, it's full of boulders. It's a very loose soil, something you don't dare touch, but she wants to fall. And I'm sure to this day they still got rocks falling in the road all during the year. I know they do. It's just a maintenance problem for them, and there's no way to correct it by carving into that mountain. And what I'm afraid, I don't know if we'd call this erosion. I call it kind of a form of erosion, sudden erosion. Maybe we can call it landslides. But I do believe of all the places in Maine I've worked, I've never seen a soil so quick to react as this soil was when it was disturbed below it. And believe me, that mountain is steep. When you do make side cuts in that mountain, or if you're blasting and shaking that soil, or if you have a turbine running, which does vibrate, these soils are not stable. They will fall in a sudden fashion. If, in carving in the side of this mountain, you change the water course of a springs. We encountered many springs in our cuts up there on Route 27. If you change the course of these springs, it will go back down in the ground. And I'm on such steep slopes, I'm just afraid your stability issues are going to be a big factor on this project. I really believe that. And only because I have never seen soils quite like the soils on this mountain. And I've worked throughout this state. And I've worked on mountains. I've worked Saddleback Mountain. I've worked this mountain. And these soils are completely different. They're very loose. Very loose soils. So I came up here today just to impart that story to you for what it's worth. And thank you for listening.
Kevin?
Hello, hello. I'm Kevin Clark. A woman earlier asked to be sworn in. I was a little late. That's why I'm probably one of the last on the list. So I apologize. It came about 6:30. I don't know if I need to.
You do.
Okay.
So raise your right hand.
Yes.
And repeat after me. Do you solemnly swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
I solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I'm a resident of Eustace. I've lived in Maine all my life and born in Waterville. But I've been up here, moved up here with my family a number of years ago, and we've been building up on Eustace Ridge. And I abut Jay Wyman. It's been interesting hearing some of the things that were said. And I'll try and be as concise as I can. I have a photograph, but I don't have a means of presenting it. So I was wondering if I could give you the photograph, because what my, just even if it's temporary, is if I'm holding it like this. Because I'm one of the people who can see the existing, I can see 11 of the existing wind towers. And I believe I'll probably, based on TransCanada's projections, I think I'm going to see most of the next phase two. My thought is, I said, well, I really should go up and say something because I'm looking at this every day. And so if it's okay, could I give you just a handout? Pretend it's a big fold. I can take that.
Yeah, it needs to go to Marshall.
Okay.
I just don't know how to show it off to you.
Marshall.
Okay. Do you have more than one copy?
Yeah, I have copies of all of them.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Yeah, I was going to hand one. You know, that's all.
Yep, that's fine.
Just as if I had a poster board.
Yep, she needs one for the public record.
Make sure I've got enough. And all it's showing is, like I say, what I see from where I am on Eustis Ridge. That's, you can see a little tower on the top, and that was the existing meteorological tower that's been up there. But when Kibbe was talking about, or when they were talking about putting these towers on the Kibbe Range, I said, well, maybe the impact won't be so much, because it's kind of hard to see that tower for me on a clear day. You have to even look at it on that photo. And the only thing I was concerned about was going to be the blinking red lights, you know, because I heard that that was going to be part of it. But the reason I brought the photo in is because it's basically what's occurred on the ground as opposed to what I thought was coming, I guess you'd say. The towers, if they're on top of a mountain ridge, they do kind of get lost in the background, and especially in the winter. It's not quite so bad. But what's happened, if you look at the existing development, I should have brought more photos, but they're all kind of backlit. You know, there's a setting of a mountain behind them. So you get this white tower in front of a thing like that. So much to my surprise, I said, wow, those, you can really see those. And like I say, I'm seeing about 11 of those existing ones. And the next phase will be on my side, the south side. So I'll be looking at, I believe, probably most of the next crew. And it's basically to, you know, everybody talking about, I don't really care for the visual impact. And that's what the photo is about. I happen to like taking photos. So one of those photos was to, you know, I've taken the top photo there from 2006 shows, you know, what I saw before they started working on the hillside, as the previous speaker said. And I understand to get the long blades and all that hardware up there, you need a pretty significant road. And I guess my concern is that right now when you look up there from Earl Wyman Jr.'s land or my land or anybody up on Eustis Ridge, an entire Risbera development from the Strunk household and everywhere else, you've kind of got a continuous flow of mountains on that side. Round Mountain, Snow Mountain, Bag Pond Mountain, Chain of Ponds, and then you get where it hits 27, where Sisk starts, you've got this big chunk now between, you know, most of your due north view will be wind towers from the ridge. And it's mostly, my whole point is, based on that photo, is that's what's always going to be there from my perspective, is it's just quite a bit more marring than I ever expected. It looks like, and I know that a clear cut is one thing, because it'll come back, but the marring of the significant roads that have to go in, obviously you can see it in the photo. And that's just to get to the existing project where those roads were made, I believe. So where they're planning on putting the new ones, I believe it's just going to continue, unfortunately. And the sheer number of roads I read in just the irregular about going on Sisk was like, wow, they're even going to be just doing a lot more. So that was what my biggest concern is, as far as the use of the land and the sort of the permanence of that kind of scarring and marring. Don't mean to use strong terms, but it's what it is. You can see it in the photo. So that's why I wanted to present that because it shows a before and after, you know, whether you like it or not. It's like, well, that's what it is, you know. And my concern being that, I go fishing on chain of ponds. I go out on Flagstaff. You can see it at blinking lights as you're going through the S-turns and Flagstaff, all that. We all know it. But even just the power line, the only thing I've been upset with TransCanada on that people couldn't get together on going through Copeland Plantation, having to double the width of the the transmission lines. You know, that was kind of, so now over Porcupine Hill, you know, in downtown Stratton, Copeland Plantation, you see this massive swath cutting across now, which, you know, you see them on major transmission lines around the state. I just wish they could have doubled up their pole or something. But so I guess my concern is mostly on the visual impact, and I thought I'd just say, hey, here's what I see, because I'm up there, and when my son falls asleep, we're looking at blinking red lights now. You know, you got this nice, and then blink, blink, you know, and it's just going to increase. And my hope is that, you know, I think the goal is to build the second half, but then this next one that's being proposed here for CISC, maybe it's because some of the financial impact has been good in the local community for the short term, like people have said, but I think they're doing it because they can, you know, and why not? Because it's been cordoned off as wind territory maybe by the governor and whatnot, but it's, like I say, I'm one of the people who actually looks at it all day long. So there's a lot of other good stuff. I can turn around and look at Preserve Bigelow, and that's good news. I feel lucky. People come up and say, this is God's country. And I say, yeah, but now in God's country, there's a wind farm showing up. So it's kind of a shame. People are curious when they come up and say, oh, are you going to see those? And they come right up, and they go, oh, yeah, there they are. So I just wanted to give you the visual impact of what I see. And I appreciate your time and sticking through all of this all night. So I don't know if you want me to take those away as if it's the poster board, or you can hold on to them, or whatever you'd like. And okay. Oh, no, that's okay. I was going to give you another shot of what I see of the existing towers, and I was going to ask if that's something, just as an existing, as a secondary submission, to say, here's what I see of the existing towers. I don't know if that's another photo I could present. It's kind of last minute, but I was like digging through photos because I'm always, it's a beautiful zone up there. So taking lots of photos, I just have to go find. This is what I'm looking at because I want to say, here's a good solid representation.
You can submit more information if you want up until
submit more information, I think, up until the 10th.
Okay, that sounds great. Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. And like I say, I appreciate you guys having the hearings and waiting through all the information.
That's all I have on the list here, Gwen. I don't know if there's others who wish to testify.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify? I guess seeing none, I have to read a statement here. Let me see if I can find it.
Excuse me. We could still testify when we're on that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. This hearing will be continued tomorrow morning, May 12th at 8 o'clock in the morning, to hear testimony from the applicant, the interveners, and government agencies. A second session to hear testimony from the public will be held tomorrow evening, May 12th, starting at 6 p.m. And I think that's all. Does anybody else have anything else? Okay, so I adjourn this meeting. Thank you all for coming.